This is the Observations Podcast for Sunday, the 9th of March, 2025. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Dale Franks. Michael is not here this evening, and I'm not entirely sure when he might be back. I don't feel like I should give you any details about what might be going on, except to say that I'm sure he'd appreciate it if you keep him and his family in your thoughts over the coming days and weeks. But with that, I will try to soldier on by myself. Maybe for the time being, there might be some format changes to the podcast. I'm certain that without any sort of conversation, the podcast is probably going to be shorter if it's just going to be barking at you for an hour and a half. I'm not sure that anybody wants to sit through that, but we will try to soldier on until such time as Michael can return. There are a couple of people that I might drag in, or at least invite in, to do little interview style podcasts here and there over the next couple of weeks. So stay tuned. We'll figure something out. Worst comes to worst, I'll just have to do some level of show prep before each podcast, and we'll get it all started. So as always, because I'm by myself, if you want to talk to me, please do so in the live chat. As always, of course, like, comment, subscribe, or dislike, comment, and subscribe. It doesn't matter. All of it counts as engagement. All of it helps the podcast, whether you like it or not. So if you want to write the usual hate-filled YouTube screed that often shows up in the comments, please feel free to do so. I'm perfectly happy to allow you to do that, because just the number of comments is great, whether they're good or bad. I love the way the algorithm works like that. I have two things to talk about tonight, both of which about what... Okay, let me pull back. One of which the Trump administration is certainly doing, which I don't like. The other of which is something the Trump administration may be doing, and I'm not sure whether we're going to like it or not. Only time will tell. But let's talk about the thing that I don't like, and that is tariffs. Donald Trump is no stranger to talking about tariffs. In fact, he's been talking about them since the 1980s. So he went on TV in the 1980s and had an interview with Diane Sawyer, and he said in that interview, "I believe very strongly in tariffs." And he criticized Germany, Japan, especially Japan, for the tariff barriers they had. And here's what he wrote. "America is being ripped off. We're a debtor nation. We have to tax. We have to tariff. We have to protect this country." Okay. Now, I'm not entirely sure how being a debtor nation means that we have to tariff, but we'll put that aside. I'm really interested in this idea. And again, this is an idea he's had since the 1980s, which is that these heathen foreigners are ripping us off. They're charging us tariffs, but we're not charging them tariffs, and it's fundamentally unfair. That mode of thinking is difficult for me to understand, because that's not how tariffs work. To listen to Donald Trump talk, one would think that if I have 1,000 widgets that I want to export to America, that I've got to show up at a bank teller's window somewhere and write a check and say, "Here, I'm writing a check to the Department of Treasury for the 1,000 widgets I'm exporting to the United States." But that's not how tariffs work. The people who actually pay the tariffs are the people in the United States who buy the goods. So you may be a wholesaler, and or a retailer, for example, if you import, you know, Japanese cars or German cars to a car dealership, then obviously you have to pay those import duties whenever you buy the item at its wholesale price. And by the way, you are paying the import duty for whatever the wholesale price is that you're paying, not the retail price. But Americans are paying those taxes. It's not the foreigners who are paying them. When we export to Germany, and the Germans or the Japanese or whoever, or the Canadians in this case, since it's Canada and Mexico that are the proximate causes of Donald Trump's irritation at the moment, the Canadians are the ones who pay those taxes, or the Canadians, as they buy American goods, they're the ones who pay those taxes. And whenever we import goods, we're the one who pay the taxes. So Trump's argument is essentially that because the Canadians, and look, the Canadians are an egregious example. The Canadians have a bunch of tariffs on us, like tariffs on milk at 200% and some, which is outrageous. But the question is, okay, well, remember, we're just not buying those goods from Canada. And of course, 200% tariffs make American goods impossible to buy in Canada as well. But if anyone wanted to buy American milk, they would be the ones that paid the price. And therefore, just because the Canadians are taxing, or the Canadian government is taxing Canadian citizens more than we tax our citizens, does that mean that we should tax our citizens more because that would be more fair? Because that's how tariffs work. So what Donald Trump is essentially saying is the Canadians tax their people so much that the only way to play fair is for us to tax our people just as much. So it doesn't make much sense because tariffs don't work the way that Donald Trump explains that they work. And what tariffs actually do is protect industries. The Canadians don't have a 200% tariff on American milk because they want to tax their citizens more. What they're doing is protecting the Canadian dairy industry from any competition with the United States. And if we impose taxes on the Canadians, then by definition, we're protecting our industries here in the United States as well. Now, we can have a lot of arguments about protection and whether some industries deserve protection and whether they don't. But that's not the context in which Donald Trump is framing this. He's framing this like we have to charge the Canadians more. That's not what's really going to happen. We just won't buy those goods, and it will protect American dairy farmers. Now, the president has a lot of authority on taxes and a lot of authority on tariffs. The reason he has that authority is because Congress has basically shoved all of the tariff level management onto the Oval Office because Congress didn't want to do it themselves. And the reason why Congress didn't want to do it themselves is because every single lobbyist that could afford to send somebody to Washington, D.C. was sending lobbyists to go around to congressmen, and it was very corrupting because they were trying to get congressmen to impose tariffs to protect their particular business. And for businesses that were export-led, they wanted all kinds of cutouts and rollbacks and special considerations for their business. And if enough money was changing hands, congressmen were perfectly happy to provide those carve-outs for American businesses that asked for it, or to impose tariffs on foreign businesses to ensure that they couldn't compete economically with American producers. Ultimately, the point of tariffs is not to make the heathen foreigners pay our taxes. It is to make foreign goods relatively unaffordable compared to the industry goods that you're trying to protect. And because Congress found it so corrupting to control tariffs, they just said, well, we'll just toss this all at the president. Then nobody comes to us and tries to bribe congressmen. Everybody can just go and try to bribe the president. And technically, it's much harder to bribe the president through lobbying than it is to bribe a congressman or a senator. And if you put a lobbyist in Washington, D.C. to go talk to Congress about tariffs, they would all just say, no, we don't do anything with tariffs. That's all an Oval Office deal. President controls all that. So no use talking to us. And okay, great. Now the president is in control of tariffs. And what that does is, A, it prevents Congress from getting involved in a fundamental issue of both trade and foreign relations, as well as economics and tax and budgetary issues. Congress has just sloughed that all off on the president, so Congress doesn't have to deal with it anymore. And in fact, Congress has done this in all manner of things. Every time Congress writes legislation now, part of the legislation always says the Secretary of Commerce or the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Transportation, whoever it might be, shall enforce this legislation through the appropriate regulation, which gives enormous power to the executive branch to determine what the law is, because Congress doesn't want to do their job. And tariffs are just one of those other areas where Congress clearly doesn't want to do their job, and so they've put it on to the president. We've kind of created an imperial presidency via Congress so that Congress doesn't actually have to do anything. And if anything goes wrong, you can always point to the president and blame him. Now, Donald Trump talks a lot about McKinley and the McKinley tariffs. And oh my goodness, we were so rich that we had to have a blue ribbon commission. Okay, fine. That is true at a time when the United States government spent about 2% of GDP. Federal government spending was very small, and the federal government was rich. However, what Trump does not talk about with the McKinley tariffs are the political effects that they had once McKinley passed them. So in 1890, the Tariff Act of 1890, which we call the McKinley Tariff, by the way, I know it's Wikipedia, and I know that for many things, Wikipedia is an unreliable source, but generally for historical economic events that took place 130 years ago, Wikipedia is fairly accurate in their relaying of the events. And the important thing about the McKinley tariffs were, once he imposed them, and by the way, at least McKinley was fully honest. He said, I'm imposing these tariffs. I want these tariffs imposed to protect American businesses. Okay, as far as that goes. But here's what happened. Once he threw that tariff in, Americans, and by the way, we're talking about 40% tariffs. Actually, all imports had tariffs raised up to somewhere between 38 and 49.5%. The immediate reaction was poor because Americans suffered a steep increase in prices. Remember, the heathen foreigners don't pay the tariffs. The Americans who buy the goods do. And Americans were not happy at many goods having those prices increased by 50%. How unhappy were they, you ask? Well, here you go. The Republican number of seats in the House declined from 171 to 88 because of these tariffs. So that was bad for McKinley, and it was bad for the Republicans, because once people saw that they had to pay the bill, or what Trump referred to last week as there'll be some, what did he say in his joint speech last week? There'll be some adjustments. That's the word. What a delightful word. And the adjustment, in this case, would be a 25% price increase on everything from Canada and Mexico. Well, the public in 1890 did not respond well to the adjustments. And of course, in 1892, Grover Cleveland, who had been tossed out of the White House in 1888, he was a Democrat, like Donald Trump, after 4 years of McKinley, he came back. And not only did he come back, but the Senate, House, and presidency all ended up under Democratic control. So prior to Donald Trump's election last November, Grover Cleveland, the only president who has been elected twice for non-consecutive terms, Donald Trump now joins him with that. So there are political risks to these tariffs. If they go through. Because it's not entirely clear whether these tariffs will actually be imposed. He said, I'm going to impose 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico. Then he comes back and says, well, no, I'm not going to do it. Then a week later, you know what? I'm going to do it after all. Businesses need some sort of policy stability to be able to plan what their business is going to look like economically for the next year, 2 years, 3 years. And this flip-flopping over these policies makes it almost impossible to do that because you can't plan. You don't know if these things are going to be put in place or not. One of the things I find very interesting about Donald Trump talking about tariffs in the way that he does is that in his first term, he just discarded NAFTA and negotiated a new trade deal with both Canada and Mexico, which he said was the best trade deal we've ever had. It was a wonderful trade deal. NAFTA was awful, but Donald Trump's trade deal was great. Joe Biden did not overturn or replace, and neither did Congress, the trade deal that I forget what the acronyms are for that trade deal, but nobody's overturned it. That's the trade deal we still work with for Mexico and Canada. So why was it so great 5 years ago when Donald Trump negotiated it? And why is it so awful now? Because what Donald Trump is saying, in effect, is, you know that trade deal I negotiated with Mexico and Canada? That was a bad deal, and we're getting screwed. Okay, so whose fault would that be? The Canadians or the Mexicans, or the president who negotiated the trade deal? Now, in chat, Inebriated Plutarch says, it's mostly a negotiating tactic. Okay, you say that. And yet, we have to go back 40 years to the 1980s when Donald Trump first began saying how strongly he believed in tariffs. Donald Trump has believed in tariffs for 30 years. So sure, maybe it's mostly a negotiating tactic, but it is a negotiating tactic from a guy who has consistently, for 40 years, said that we need tariffs because we're getting screwed by these other countries. And he's saying we need tariffs now because the trade deal that he said was the best trade deal in the world that America's ever had 5 or 6 years ago is now this horrible trade deal that has to be overturned and, in fact, replaced with tariffs. Although he did come out at the end of this week and say, well, anything that's covered under that trade deal, we're not going to tariff on. Then that covers almost everything. So then what are we going to tariff on? The thing I don't like about it is, A, I don't like the policy of tariffs anyway. For a number of economic reasons, we'll talk about in a second. But B, it even as a negotiating tactic, if you're going to exempt everything from the trade deal that he negotiated, well, it doesn't cover much of anything. So how much of a threat is it? So how useful of a negotiating tactic might it be if you're only talking about tariffs on things that aren't covered under the current deal that, again, Donald Trump negotiated and touted as the best trade deal ever between the United States and Mexico. He said 5 or 6 years ago that he brought the Canadians and the Mexicans to heel and imposed a trade deal on them that was better than NAFTA. Well, maybe, but then why is it such a bad deal now? From the economic side, the reason why it bothers me are both Donald Trump and some of the people who are on his side have characterized what its results would be rather differently. Oh, by the way, I forgot something. Let me go back to my historical talk about tariffs. In addition to the McKinley tariffs, which basically tossed McKinley out of office, lost him re-election, lost Congress to the Democrats, and replaced McKinley with a Democratic president, there are the Smoot-Hawley tariffs from 1930. I think every economist would agree that those tariffs made the economy worse. However, there is a colorable argument. Jude Waninsky, the father of supply-side economics, in his book How the World Works, made the argument, which is echoed here by Alan Reynolds from the Cato Institute, that the Smoot-Hawley tariffs did not simply make the recession or the Great Depression worse. They actually caused the Great Depression. And one of the things that he did, and that Alan Reynolds does here in this particular article, which I suppose I should share with you, is he actually went through the legislative history throughout 1929 of the Smoot-Hawley tariff bill and how the Dow Jones Industrial Average responded as this tariff bill began to move through Congress. Now, in this case, we were talking about basically 60% tariffs on everything. And so during June, while the House was talking about it and passing it, stock prices began to drift lower. They dropped from, this is back in the old days when the Dow Jones Industrial Average wasn't at 42,000. It was at 196 in March. It dropped to June, or dropped to 191 in June. Okay, Senate Finance Committee met to rewrite the bill. It looked like there was going to be an improvement in what came out, so the market rallied a bit. And by September, it was up to about 216, so a huge rise in the stock market. And then, on October 21st, the Senate rejected a move to limit the tariff increases. And by October 23rd, it looked as if the Democrats had just completely lost in the Senate the anti-tariff argument, and stocks began to collapse in the last hour of trading. The following morning, the stock market crashed. That's what we call Black Thursday. And so there was an argument to be made that the Smoot-Hawley tariff bills did not just make the Depression really bad, but that they may have caused it by tanking the stock market on Black Thursday, which had enormous repercussions. We don't need to get into why, except to say that a lot of people were borrowing a lot of money to buy stocks, thinking that stock prices would rise and they could pay off those loans. And then when the stock market collapsed, all those margin calls started coming in and said, okay, we want the money in cash now. And people didn't have the money and they went bankrupt. They were just cleaned out because they literally couldn't meet their margin calls. And then, of course, everything just fell apart. So here's the thing. So let me go back to what I was saying before I forgot about this, which is the promise of how tariffs are going to help. In fact, some have talked about, even the president himself has at least mentioned, that these tariffs will help, might replace the income tax. Is that possible? Could that happen? Short answer, no. Long answer, let's take a look at some numbers. So in 2023, now 2023 is the last year for which we have full numbers. It's only March, so we haven't even hit, well, we just hit our first revision of GDP, January, February, March? No, we have not even reached the first revision of quarter four 2024. So we don't fully know what 2024's GDP was yet. There'll be a revision in April. There'll be another revision made January, February, March. Then April, May, June. So there'll be a revision in April. There'll be another revision at the 1st of July, the second revision. Then we'll have a pretty good idea. There's technically a third revision in September, but or October, but the 1st of October. But by the second revision, we have a pretty good idea. But right now, we don't have a full 2024 number. So let's look at the 2023 number. So current level of GDP in 2023, all of GDP, $27.94 trillion. So that was our total GDP. Okay, great. So how much of that, how much of GDP do we pay for imports? What is the total value of imports that we brought into the country in 2023? Well, we're going to have to scroll down a little farther on here and get to the annual summary for 2023. So total imports were $3.8 trillion or $3,826 billion. But yeah, let's round it out, $3.8 trillion. Okay, $27.7 trillion of GDP, but only $3.8 trillion of imports. So these are the only items on which a tariff could apply. Would tariffs be able to pay for the federal government? Well, no, of course not. Because if we look at the 2023 budget, total outlays in 2023 were $6.1 trillion. So if you only have $3.8 trillion in imports that you can tax via tariffs, and you're spending $6.1 trillion in expenses, you could tax those imported goods at 100%, and you would pay for slightly more than half of the federal budget. And that assumes a 100% tariff. What it also assumes is something that isn't true, which is that the amount of goods that are imported into the United States would be the same if you had a 100% tariff. They would not. The reason why Canadians have such high tariffs on milk is because they know that American milk simply won't make it into Canada because the tariff barriers are too high. Nobody is going to pay $12 a gallon for a gallon of milk. Same thing would happen here if we had high tariffs on imported goods, then we wouldn't import $3.8 trillion worth of them. Those would drop. And what the Canadians have also said is that, oh, by the way, we are going to impose tariffs on the United States then. And so everything that comes in from the United States, that'll be tariffed. Okay, so that implies that the amount that we're able to export to Canada or Mexico, because the Mexicans will do the same thing, those will drop as well. Trade overall will fall because that's what taxes do. If you want less of something, you tax it. That's how incentives work. If you make something more expensive via taxation, you'll get less of it. That is one of the intended side effects of taxation. Taxation on trade penalizes trade, so you're going to get less of it. So we are never going to pay for our total federal budget and get rid of the IRS via tariffs on imports. It is mathematically impossible. The numbers don't lie. So I don't understand what we're being told about tariffs and why he thinks they're so good. What we do know is that he's thought tariffs were great for 40 years, And apparently nothing that has happened in the last 40 years, or nothing that happened to the McKinley presidency or the Hoover presidency with the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, nothing has happened that has forced him to change his mind. He has become convinced, as far as I can tell, that the heathen foreigners are cheating on us and tariffs will make them pay. When, in point of fact, I don't know that it's cheating if you say that foreigners are protecting their markets. I guess it's, we don't like it, but you're penalizing Americans for buying foreign goods. And maybe you think that is an absolute good, and you're perfectly willing to think so. You know, economics doesn't tell us what we should do. Economics tells us this is what the cost of this decision will be. If you do X, it's going to cost you Y. Whether Y is something that we want and whether we're willing to pay it, that's a judgment call. It's not an economic call. And if we decide that that's what we want, then fine, that's what we're going to get. But I'll tell you one thing we are not going to get are so much money in tariffs that it's going to eliminate the income tax. Don't get me wrong. We should eliminate the income tax. Income taxation is just outright theft. But that's a topic for another podcast. We won't climb down that well tonight. Second thing the Trump administration is doing is one that I find much more intellectually interesting, and it's also one in which I think we're entering into, at least in modern terms, uncharted waters. And I don't know whether it will be good or bad, but it is going to happen. I think it's inevitable. This whole idea of Russia and Ukraine and how to end the war in Ukraine is an interesting one. We can, I think, rather simplistically talk about the Ukraine war as just total Russian expansionism. And I'm not a friend of Russia. As I said last week, I spent, you know, a good part of my military career in Europe waiting for the Soviets to come across the Fulda Gap. And Vladimir Putin is not a good man. Now, we didn't actually always think of him as a bad man. In fact, we can go all the way back to Bill Clinton in 2000, where Bill Clinton said, under President Putin, Russia has the chance to build prosperity and strength while safeguarding the rule of law. Well, certainly that's one way it could have gone, but it wasn't the only way it could have gone. We also had George W. Bush, I remember quite famously, said that he had looked into Putin's soul and thought he was a fairly good fellow, thought he was somebody we could trust. And maybe Putin, maybe George W. Bush was right. The problem is that we had by then convinced Putin that we were not somebody that he could trust. And I'll tell you why. Back in the good old days at the end of the Cold War, we sat down with Mikhail Gorbachev and the Soviet leaders at that time, who were in 1990 and 1991, basically, and through 1992, basically preparing to and ultimately did just dissolve the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics into its constituent republics. And so Ukraine, Belarus, Azerbaijan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, they all became, well, Georgia, nominally independent countries. What we promised Russia, not just Gorbachev, but later on Yeltsin, was what U.S. James Baker basically said, not one inch eastward for NATO expansion. So that was the promise on which the Russians relied, and certainly Gorbachev relied, in arguing toward to the Soviet government that we could be trusted if the Soviet Union fell apart, not to encroach on what the Soviets saw as their sphere of interest, what the Russians called the near abroad, which again, Ukraine, Belarus, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia as well, Poland, depending on how you define the near abroad in Russian terms, maybe, well, actually almost certainly, and then of course Georgia, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, et al. That's all what Russia considers their sphere of interest. We haven't talked much about spheres of interest, but we'll get to there. But for right now, we just need to know that what we told the Soviets, and after Gorbachev, Yeltsin, that we would not expand NATO eastward. That was in 1991, 1992. 8 years later, well, 7 years later, in 1999, we did it anyway. Now, I'm not saying this to, you know, say that we're responsible somehow for the for World War One, or for Russia's involvement in Ukraine, but I would make the comparison to World War One. Germany didn't start World War One because they built up a fleet that could challenge the Royal Navy. However, it did kind of make war more likely because it made Germany seem like an outsized threat to Great Britain. The idea was that, well, it's one thing if Germany was a continental hegemon in terms of land power. It's another thing entirely if Germany is not only the most powerful land army in Europe, but they're also second only to the Royal Navy as a sea power in the world in general, that becomes a much greater threat. People don't really realize how in the end of the 1800s, so between 1880 through about 1903, 1904, the Germans, especially Kaiser Wilhelm, who, by the way, was Queen Victoria's grandson, and he loved Queen Victoria, loved his mother, he loved England. The Germans were trying to get the British into an alliance with them. And they figured that a, you know, British sea power and German land power on the continent would make an axis, if I can use the term, of Germany and England unbeatable. Now, unfortunately, the Kaiser, while he loved England and he loved Grandma, Grandma Vicky, he also was, A, not a super intelligent fella, and B, very impetuous. And so what they did is he kept pissing England off, ultimately. And the Germans, and there's a very good book, Thomas K. Massey, the historian, wrote a book called Dreadnought about going into World War One. It's a very encyclopedic examination of both Germany and from both the German and British viewpoint of the from about 1880 or 1890 all the way up to the start of World War One, about how their relationship developed. And it's fascinating. And one of the things that comes out is that the Germans thought, well, and talk about totally misunderstanding how the world works. Germany thought, well, if we build a big fleet, it'll threaten Britain enough that she'll want to ally with us. Yeah, that's not how that works. And so the Germans made war more likely. Now, the Russians are xenophobic paranoids. And so being in the position of having to watch while NATO expanded eastward was not pleasant to them. And by the way, they think that we did it to take advantage of them, or at least they were in a position where we could take advantage of them. Because what Boris Yeltsin did whenever the Soviet Union fell apart, Boris Yeltsin rather stupidly turned over control of many state factories and organizations. Because remember, the Soviet Union, the state owned everything, right? Everything was owned by the people, by which we mean the state. And Yeltsin's privatization plan was awful, and the people he sold off government assets to were almost invariably criminals. And so during the mid and end of the 90s, basically the mafia, the Russian mafia, ran the country. And the government, the people, because of the government's privatization policy was such a failure, there was so much disruption in the economy. And look, going from a planned state economy to a market economy is probably not a super easy thing to do for a political class that has always run everything in detail. And so they also want to run the privatization in detail. They generally would be expected to do it very badly. Yeltsin did it very badly. And the people who were really hurt by this were the Russian people, who saw the value of their currency just go to nothing. Massive inflation, a huge black market erupted because the same people who owned the factories or who had bought them from Yeltsin were also the same people who were producing things and making extra profits in the black market. It was a complete shit show in Russia for about 10 years. The reason why Putin got elected is because people thought that he might be able to bring back some sort of stability that under Yeltsin, the Russians had completely lost. But because Russia was so unstable and because there was no real understanding of how the economy worked, because everything was kind of in shambles and criminals were pretty much running the entire country, it was a great time to expand NATO eastward at a time when the Russians could not really oppose it. And so Putin sees this as really a fundamental betrayal by the people in the West who told him, we're never going to expand. And the people in the West who did the expanding just assumed that because the Soviet Union was gone and because Russia was kind of in a shambolic state at the time, that that was a permanent state of affairs and they could just, you know, slap Russia around a little bit and there wasn't much that the Russians could do. And that's true. There wasn't much the Russians could do at that time. But the Russians have long memories and they don't forget. Vladimir Putin, whenever he was being interviewed by Tucker Carlson, started off his interview with a 20-minute screed about Kievan Rus in the 9th century. I don't really have any personal quarrels that go back to the 9th century, but apparently the Russians do. They don't forgive and they don't forget. So there is an environment around the Ukraine war that is unfortunate and that we might have avoided. And we don't even get into the color revolution in Ukraine when Yanukovych was tossed out and replaced ultimately by not at the time, but later on by Zelensky. So there's a whole history there. We're not going to get into the details of any of the Ukraine-Russian war, how it started. I think everybody who is even partially fair-minded has to at least acknowledge that Russia invaded Ukraine, that there was no military casus belli to invade without warning a neighboring country. That's always bad. But the Biden administration and the European response, and still the European response, is to say, well, Putin simply can't win. We learned the lesson of appeasement in the 1930s. Yes, that's true, but we're not looking at the 1930s. The reality is that in the 1930s, when Adolf Hitler marched into the Rhineland in 1936, The entire German army had about 4 combat battalions. The French could have tritty-trotted in to the Rhineland and bumped those guys off in an afternoon. And the French chose not to because they didn't want another war with Germany. A war, I hasten to point out, that they would have won quite easily. Then as we go into 1937 and 1938, the Anschluss of Austria, nobody did anything. By this time, Germany had not only an army, but now officially an air force, and once again, a navy. But it was still in its nascent phase. At every step from the remilitarization of the Rhine to the Anschluss of Austria to Czechoslovakia, the West could have stopped Adolf Hitler, and he wasn't powerful enough to defeat them. Instead, they waited until 1939, and we had 6 years of war. Imagine how badly things would have gone if Adolf Hitler would have spent the 1930s just doing economic stuff and rebuilding Germany. Sure, building up their army, building up their navy, recreating the Luftwaffe so they have a modern air force. Imagine if he had not started World War II or marched back into the Rhineland or any of that stuff in 1942. That would have been a really, really different historical story. But the point of the appeasement problem was that at every point, the Western Allies, or what became the Western Allies, always had the power to stop Germany cold because Germany wasn't powerful enough. And that was true right up until probably 38, 39. Beyond 39, it was no longer true. But certainly, the Nazi regime would have been overthrown if Hitler had walked into the Rhine in 1936 and the French had just walked in there, shot a bunch of Germans, and kicked them out. Hitler's government probably would have fallen. Authoritarian regimes do not do well with those kind of grandiose plans that end up in humiliating defeat. So they could have stopped Hitler in 36. They chose not to. But the situation in 2020 to now, or 2022 to now, are not the same. At no point was anyone in Western Europe, no matter how much they might have wanted to, at no point was anyone going to stand up to Vladimir Putin for one reason. He had nukes. He had a real army. There was no easy method of stopping him short of essentially World War III. That's just the reality of the situation. What the Europeans are trying to do is impose their morality on you shouldn't invade foreign countries. And look, by the way, you shouldn't invade foreign countries. Putin should not have invaded Ukraine. Let's just say that clearly. And yet it happened. And we have to make the decision as to whether we are going to try, as the Europeans are doing, to make a foreign policy on these, on some sort of moral basis. And if you're going to make a policy on some moral basis, then you darn well better have the power to enforce that policy on others. And the Europeans have no such power. Europeans have no ability to project power. They have no ability to force Vladimir Putin to stop what he's doing. And if it comes right down to it, they can't prevent Vladimir Putin from just immolating Paris and London and Berlin with nuclear weapons. And they cannot respond in kind. Well, the Brits and the French could. We don't really know the size of the French arsenal, but the point being is that, well, how's that a win? If we're going to trade, Moscow and St. Petersburg for Paris and London, okay, I guess we can do that. Hard to see who comes out ahead in that exchange, if anyone. I mean, theoretically, if Russia loses Moscow and St. Petersburg, Does Russia still exist? I'm not sure. But if Great Britain loses London or Paris loses France, I mean, I guess they still exist, but are they so weakened that they play no further part in world history? These moralistic arguments that the Europeans are making simply don't work in the real world. In the real world, Russia is a country of 187 million people. Ukraine is a country of around 30 million people. And Russia has a lot more meat to put into that meat grinder than the Ukrainians will ever have. Whatever you would like morally to say about the war, and however much war onus you want to place on Vladimir Putin, what you would like to see is irrelevant. The reality is that if you want peace, A, you're gonna have to talk to Vladimir Putin. He's the only one who can pull the reins back on the Russian army. And talking to him means you're ultimately going to have to give him something he wants. He's definitely going to want Crimea, and he's probably going to want Donetsk and Luhansk at minimum. And you're going to have to make that deal, because the supply of fighting soldiers in Ukraine compared to Russia is not illimitable. Russia can always win the meat grinder. And by the way, even in the wars that Russia has won, they've won it by tossing millions of men into the meat grinder until the meat got ground. And so the reality is, A, Russia's going to get something out of this. And B, we're going to have to talk to Vladimir Putin. His diplomatic isolation has to end, and that is what Trump is doing. I personally don't like the way Trump talks about Putin. He talks about him like he's a really good guy and maybe just slightly misunderstood. Vladimir Putin is not a good guy. Vladimir Putin is an authoritarian. He runs Russia like his own personal dog kennel. It is as corrupt a country as you can imagine. The lieutenant general who ran Russia's armaments procurement program has like a $2.5 million dacha outside of Moscow. Pretty sure he didn't buy that off of just his salary as a lieutenant general in the army of the Russian Federation. I'm pretty sure he has external sources of income that his job as the head of procurement made much more lucrative than they would otherwise have been. But we're going to have to talk to the guy, because we can't fight forever. It's interesting. The Europeans are not willing to send their armies, well, maybe as a peacekeeping force, but nobody's talking about sending their armies in to beat Vladimir Putin. In the real world, if you want to return to status quo ante before the 2022 invasion, the Ukrainians are not going to be able to push the Russians out. They simply don't have the manpower. So that means European soldiers and American soldiers are going to have to put boots on the ground, and we're going to have to go combat head-to-head with the Russians and push them out of Luhansk and Donetsk. Maybe even Ukraine. Okay, sure. Let's go with that. At what point does Vladimir Putin say, you know what, I would rather use tactical nuclear weapons on this battlefield than allow the Western powers to push to the border? Because can I trust them that they say they're going to push to the border and then stop? Or will they invade metropolitan Russia? I don't know. Do you want to take that chance with the guy? So I said all that to say this. A couple of months ago, I wrote about how the post-World War II world is coming to an end. And we actually talked about it a bit on the podcast. And my major point is that since 1945, we have lived in an extraordinary period of human history. Because for all of the world prior to 1945, international relations were governed by great power jockeying back and forth to pursue each nation's interests. And it doesn't matter whether you call that nation Egypt or Akkad or Samaria or Babylon or Persia or France or the United Kingdom or Germany. The great power game is how international relations have been conducted since the dawn of history. We created something special in 1945, what we call now the rules-based international order. And it was fine while it worked in a predictable bipolar world with the U.S. on one side, the Russians on the other, and with both sides having a relative commitment to the idea of a rules-based international order. Even when the Soviets did something hugely assholish, they always managed to couch it in the sort of language that was compatible with the idea of a rules-based international order. So, for example, their invasion of Afghanistan in 1980. Well, it wasn't an invasion of Afghanistan, first of all. There was a revolution in Afghanistan. A new government had been installed. That new government invited Soviet forces to come into Afghanistan to restore order. The argumentation that the Soviets used was the type of argumentation that was compatible with the rules-based international order. And the rules-based international order served us well until the Soviet Union fell apart. We don't live in that bipolar two superpower world where there is a relative measure of accommodation with each other. We are now back in the pre-1945 world, or should I say, we are back in the normal world, the special era of the post-World War II rules-based international order is, as far as I can tell, over. And Donald Trump realizes it, and he is pushing the United States back towards becoming a great power in the term that we would have, that Lord Palmerston would have understood in the 1800s in Great Britain. And Lord Palmerston's axiom, which is a very important one, is that nations do not have permanent friends. They have permanent interests. And if you look at Britain, boy, we're going to fight the Germans with the French. No, now we're going to fight the French with the Germans. Now we're going to fight the Spaniards. Now we're going to fight with the Spaniards against the French. The Allies change all the time. What did not change is Great Britain's continuing policy, which they pursued over hundreds of years, which was you cannot allow a single power to have hegemonic power over the continent. And if there is one, you can use sea power to blockade them, to transport troops, and to provide a backup to the second strongest power on the continent so that you can be the counterweight to anyone from taking over all of Europe. That's been the game that Britain has played because that is in their permanent interest. Or at least it was until 1945 at the end of World War II when we set up an entirely different system. The Europeans are still stuck in that system. They seem incapable of seeing a great power world, a return to normalcy, because they're so wedded to the idea of the rules-based international order. But the rules-based international order only works as long as all of the players agree that it works. The second it no longer works, you're back in the normal phase of human history where great powers determine what's going to happen. And the great powers always have spheres of influence. So what I believe we're seeing is the United States withdrawing from Europe, coming back to the Western Hemisphere, and setting up a sphere of interest in North and South America. The Chinese sphere of influence is going to be Asia, and the Russian sphere of influence is going to be in Europe. Europe is a special case because Europe has nations that are potentially as powerful as, even if they don't have the same population, but in terms of combat power, are more powerful than the Russians will ever be. Look, Russia has always been the idiot stepsister of Western civilization. That's just a fact. The Russians have never been as advanced, they've never been as competent, and they've never been as effective as the other Western nations. Their only saving grace has been the fact that they could put millions of people into the battlefield. And quantity, as Stalin said, has a quality all of its own. But the Europeans could oppose Russia in a great power sense, and the Europeans would need to, A, rearm themselves, and B, be willing to play great power politics, and be willing to resign the rules-based international order, as useful as it has been for pretty much the entire life of everyone who has been born since 1945, it's not the normal way that international relations work. And if we're going to go back to normality, which is great powers, then we're going to have to be very cautious about interfering. Whatever moral arguments we might want to make, we're going to have to be very cautious about interfering with the other great powers. Because the problem is, all of the other great powers have nuclear weapons. And all of them can destroy each of the others. And in a situation like that, you're just simply going to have to accommodate to a world in which there are great powers, and in which those great powers have the ability to destroy you if you interfere with them too much. And we're going to need to learn what diplomacy looks like in that world, what foreign policy looks like in that world. And I think it's fascinating that of all the people and of all of the smart people that exist in politics, well, the couple of smart people that exist in politics, that it's Donald Trump, the simple businessman, who seems to have a better grasp of what the world is going to look like moving forward than all of the sophisticated Europeans. In any event, that's my piece for tonight. Have a great week. We'll look forward to talking to you next week. So long.